Hello and welcome to the Vet Blast podcast. I am your host, Dr. Adam Christman, Chief Veterinary Officer here at Fetch DVM 360.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Vet Blast podcast. What you need to know about feline heartworm, and there are some new guidelines from the American Heartworm Society. And what does that mean to you? And joining me is our wonderful friend and colleague, Dr. Kelly Mitchell in the house. How are you, my friend?
I am very well. How are you?
Well, so good to see you. And this is a great conversation. We want to thank our friends from Antech for sponsoring this great conversation. And before we begin, Dr. Mitchell, to the listeners, you know, when you find that common thread with somebody in this profession, it goes a long way. And I know I'm obsessed with dachshunds, but I didn't know you are as well.
Oh, yes. There are many things I think you and I have in common, but that might be the most important one, right? And that is that we share a very particular favorite breed, the miniature dachshund. Yes. And on top of that, miniature wire hair dachshunds. And then in some strange twist of fate, I think we just realized that we both have dogs potentially from the same breeder. So the world just got smaller.
It really has. Yeah. Well, it's wonderful.
That's fabulous. So, yeah.
Yes. Well, we're going to take it to the cats on this conversation. And to our listeners, Dr. Mitchell received her DVM degree from Western College of Veterinary Medicine, followed by a one-year rotating internship in small animal medicine and surgery at the Atlantic Veterinary Group. She completed her small animal internship medicine residency and Doctor of Veterinary Science degree at Ontario Veterinary College. She's also a diplomat of the American College of Veterinary Internal Medicine. Dr. Mitchell worked in private referral practice prior to joining Antech Consultation Services in 2017, and in September 2021, she became Director of Consultation Services in North America. Dr. Mitchell has authored and co-authored several book chapters, publications, and abstracts, and is a frequent lecturer. So, okay, well, we got a lot to talk about with feline heartworm. In fact, I don't think we talk enough about it. And, you know, I alluded to it earlier. We touched on the relatively newer feline heartworm guidelines from the American Heartworm Society. So, what do you think is important to take away from those recommendations and, you know, what they mean for heartworm management?
Yeah, thanks, Adam. In November of 2024, the American Heartworm Society published some new evidence-based guidelines on the prevention, diagnosis, and management of feline heartworm infection. There's a lot of really important information within, including details on epidemiology and pathophysiology. Overall, really, it's a great review of feline heartworm disease and an excellent summary of the literature. You know, from a clinical perspective, when I look at the American Heartworm Society guidelines, I think they emphasize four main points or buckets. That first bucket for me is awareness. Heartworm infection in cats, it's a risk, right? It's a risk wherever heartworm infection occurs in dogs, which means heartworm's been diagnosed in all 50 states, all 10 Canadian provinces, and all around the globe. Environmental and climate change, relocation of infected dogs, expansion of the territories of infected wild canids, all of these things are contributing to further spread. But because heartworm in cats is a more elusive diagnosis than in dogs, I think it can be more easily overlooked. And because heartworm screening in cats is not as commonly performed as it is in dogs, then we think, you know, in the American Heartworm Society guidelines suggest that heartworm diagnosis is likely underdiagnosed in cats. So really importantly, these guidelines are emphasizing awareness. They're emphasizing risk. And we're again emphasizing that risk exists for any cat, regardless of lifestyle, to become infected with heartworm. And I think I know what you're going to ask me next, right? Probably about indoor versus outdoor cats. And yeah, that means that this risk applies not just to outdoor cats. Indoor-only cats are at risk as well. And while the risk might be higher for cats that spend time outdoors, even cats that spend their entire lives indoors are at risk. So we know that not every indoor cat is entirely indoors. Balconies and patios and little sneaks outside that cats might do. And the other thing we know is that even cats that are entirely indoors, we do know that mosquitoes can enter homes. And one really interesting retrospective study cited in the guidelines said that approximately 25% of cats diagnosed with heartworm were considered to be completely indoor cats. So that's bucket number one. Bucket number two for me, if number one is awareness, number two is prevention, right? The American Heart Society continues to recommend that all cats be on year-round heartworm prevention. Year-round because transmission can occur year-round, even in colder climates. Year-round for the added activity some of these products have against other internal and external parasites. So thinking about our whole One Health approach, overall feline wellness, and year-round to improve compliance. Pet owner compliance with administration. So again, really an important emphasis on wellness care for cats. So that's going to be overall wellness, whether that's parasite testing, fecal parasites, external parasites, and heartworm, of course, as well. Bucket number three is annual screening. So the American Heart Society is strongly recommending annual screening of cats for heartworm. So we want to do that to establish a baseline prior to initiation of prevention. We want to do it to establish a diagnosis in infected cats. We want to continue to monitor those cats who've already been diagnosed with infection. And of course, we want to more widely screen cats in order to better inform veterinary care teams and pet owners about the risk for heartworm infection. So just trying to understand the true prevalence of disease. And the last bucket, which we can talk about a little bit later as well, is that there have been some important updates to the recommended testing and screening approach as well.
Yeah, it's very helpful and really interesting guidelines. And, you know, the presentation that cats present for heartworm is definitely different to that of dogs. So at a practical level, how is heartworm's clinical presentation different in cats versus dogs?
Yeah, so cats are not the natural definitive host for heartworm. And that results in a few differences in the pathophysiology of their disease and a few differences, important differences when we compare them to dogs. So infection intensity in cats is often lower, so maybe only 1 to 2 worms. And single-sex infections are thought to be more common in dogs in cats as compared to dogs. Now, considering cats' generally smaller body size, the American Heart Society guidelines emphasize that even 1 to 2 cats is going to represent a significant infection burden in a cat. But to your point, right, the clinical signs of infection in cats are also very different than dogs. And I think in part it leads to how this is a more elusive or difficult diagnosis in cats. So the clinical signs in cats, they're going to range from the obvious and the significant to the more subtle and nonspecific. So while we certainly want to be cognizant of the obvious and the significant, so those are going to include sudden death or a per-acute syndrome of severe respiratory or neurological signs. And sometimes cats will show clinical signs related to aberrant worm migration. So those are the obvious and the significant, but what we don't want to forget about are the subtle and the nonspecific. So signs of chronic respiratory disease are most common. So cough, increased respiratory effort or rate. Cats may also show nonspecific signs. So vague lethargy, anorexia, vomiting, weight loss, clinical signs that can also be intermittent, right? So thinking about it from that big picture, we do want to make sure that we're cognizant of these more subtle clinical signs and the differences between cats and dogs, just so that it's always on our list, right? Always something we have on the differential and we're considering for cats with appropriate clinical signs. If we're not thinking about it, then we're going to miss that opportunity to diagnose it.
Yeah, definitely miss that opportunity. And let's chat a little bit about testing, because the testing protocols might be a little bit different. So what testing protocols are recommended for identifying feline heartworm?
Yeah. So again, just to be different, right? The old cats are not small dogs saying. For cats, what is recommended is different than what we recommend or what we rely on in dogs. So for dogs, I think veterinarians, myself included, I'm pretty comfortable relying on that combination of antigen and microfilaria testing. Whereas the updated American Heart Society guidelines and heat-treated antigen testing. Right. Again, so antibody and heat treated antigen testing in cats. So we're not talking about one test, but two, right? Combination of two specific tests is recommended. And so let's talk a little bit about why, right? Why the differences. So focusing first on antigen testing compared to dogs, detection of antigenemia or antigen circulating antigen, it is much less reliable. I shouldn't say much, let's say less, right? Compared to dogs, detection of antigenemia is less reliable in cats. And there's a few reasons for that. So cats can become symptomatic secondary to migration of early larval stages. And as we said before, right, due to lower worm burdens and higher likelihood of single-sex infections, cats may have a lower level of antigenemia compared to dogs. And there's also evidence that in some cases, antigen complexing or binding with antibody interferes with antigen testing and can result in a false negative. So for all these reasons, low-level antigenemia and the potential for antigen-antibody binding, the routine heat treating of serum samples for antigen testing is recommended for cats. So the idea here is that heating the serum will break those complexes down, right? Release any antigen from antibody if that binding is occurring. And in so doing, that antigen becomes free for detection by the tests. So this is, again, a different recommendation in dogs where we're generally going to reserve heat treating of serum, not overall, pardon me, we're not going to do that on all of our canine samples, but rather we reserve heat treating for those cases where we suspect we could have a false negative antigen test. So used routinely in cats and only in certain circumstances in dogs. And looking at antibody testing, right? Given the limitations of antigen testing in cats, the guidelines recommend a multimodal approach. So specifically this concurrent antibody testing alongside the heat-treated antigen testing. And this antibody testing has the advantage of being able to detect infection by either sex, both male or female worms, as larvae of either sex can stimulate an antibody response as early as 2 months post-infection. Now, the dilemma with antibody testing generally, of course, and that remains the case here, is that it doesn't offer confirmation of continued or current infection, just that an infection or an exposure previously occurred.
Got it.
Another question we get is what about microfilaria testing in cats? Because we do rely on that so heavily in dogs. Again, different than dogs, circulating microfilaria are rarely clinically identified in cats. Cats tend to be transiently microfilariemic and the microfilaria present in low numbers. So we don't generally rely on NOTS testing or microfilaria testing in cats. And I'll just put a shout out there to what for me will always remain this idea that, especially diagnosing feline in cats, we never want to rely on a single test or even on a single test diagnosis for sure. We want to make sure we're taking that broad multimodal approach. So in addition to antibody testing, in addition to heat-treated antigen testing, we also have tools at our disposal like thoracic radiographs or an echocardiogram. And my favorite, right, a physical exam. Sometimes we're going to have clues just based on physical exam to suspect heartworm. So that might be respiratory signs, might be a new heart murmur. It might be clinical signs associated, like what we talked about earlier, or it might be, something as dramatic as a clinical sign related to aberrant migration of a worm. So putting all of that together for an overall clinical assessment.
I'll never forget. I had a 5-year-old cat patient of mine that came to me, and the owner complained that she was coming in for like an asthma attack. So you're mentally get yourself in that zone, thinking, okay. And to your point, we're taking thoracic radiographs, and I said, huh, the pulmonary, the architecture looks a little abnormal. And I ran the diagnostic test, and I was like, let's check for heartworm. Well. This cat has never been outdoors, and it was strong positive for heartworm. And mom was completely floored and shocked, but she said she does lay by the windowsill, and it happens. Cats love to do that or whatnot too. But here you're thinking that you're gonna go down the asthma side of things, and this cat had heartworm. Oh.
Right. So you're hitting on all of, well, gosh, you're hitting on so many of the things we've already just discussed, right?
Yeah.
So many things that are fun and interesting and cool about veterinary medicine. So, using those clinical signs, using those physical exam findings, taking the tools and the learnings from those thoracic rads to start your assessment wide and broad. What are causes of pulmonary pathology in cats? And then because you've got, an understanding and an exposure and an increased awareness, remember what we said about point one, bucket one of the American Heart Worm Society guidelines, you've got an awareness of heartworm disease as a risk, right? So
Yeah.
maybe that's also being contributed to by a radiologist who looks at your rads and says, gosh, there's findings here that remind me of heartworm. Have you thought about that? And then we're going to dovetail that with the idea that that risk exists wherever heartworm infection exists in dogs, the risk exists for cats as well. And we're not ruling it out based on the absence of, you know, an exclusively outdoor lifestyle, for example.
Right.
So putting all those pieces together to come to solve the puzzle. I mean, that's what I love about medicine.
Yes, I do too. I love it. It's such a great problem-solving profession. It really is so fun.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're talking about diagnostic measures, and let's pivot a little bit and talk about treatment and prevention options. So what are some treatment and prevention options that are out there?
Yeah, so treatment-wise, at present, adulticidal therapies such as milarsamine are not recommended for use in cats over concerns for toxicity and efficacy and whatnot. So again, we're not recommending milarsamine therapy, adulticidal therapy with milarsamine in cats the same way the guidelines recommend that in dogs. So treatment in cats is really focused on the symptomatic and the supportive. So we want to manage their clinical signs. That's going to encompass all forms of stabilization and supportive care. We can consider potentially tapering courses of prednisone in cats that have clinical or radiographic evidence of pulmonary disease. And there's some mention in the guidelines as well, similarly in cats with clinical or radiographic evidence of pulmonary disease, to consider other options like leukotriene inhibitors, for example. The guidelines do recommend a course of doxycycline to treat Wolbachia, which, just like in dogs, is thought to contribute to the pathogenesis of heartworm disease. And included in the treatment recommendations for heartworm-infected cats, and really paramount for all cats, is prevention, right? So we want to focus on prevention. There are several products labeled for prevention of heartworm in cats, many of which, of course, are going to carry the added benefit we've mentioned before, right, of control of some other internal and external parasites as well. My favorite place to go look is a shout out to CAPC, so the Companion Animal Parasite Council, and specifically their quick product reference guide, which is available on their website. And it allows you to filter, right? You can choose species, cat or dog, and then you can choose the parasite of interest, and it'll filter to products that are labeled for use in that particular situation. So that's where I go all the time and look, and you know, you're going to mostly find for control of, or prevention, pardon me, of heartworm in cats, moxidectin, milbamycin, selamectin, ivermectin-based products. That's really what is out there. So again, focusing on management of clinical signs, supportive care, and starting them on or maintaining them on prevention. And obviously the role of prevention in uninfected cats is paramount as well.
It is. And, you know, we're talking about more like a proactive approach than a reactive approach. We do it a lot for our dogs.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it's pivoted a lot more towards cats. And one of the things I've noticed over the past, I would say the past 2 years for sure, when I go to practices around the country, is they are including the heartworm tests within screenings for cats, for laboratory work. And in fact, are actually talking about it on their website. They're doing social media plays, and the emphasis on wellness screening for heartworm seems to be shifting in the vet community, which I think is amazing.
Course. Me too. Yeah.
Yeah. So what recommendations do you have for communicating with pet owners across when we talk about spectrum of care, especially, you know, those cat owners that may not understand the need for regular heartworm screening?
Yeah, I think it's really about us, all of us, veterinary care teams, doing our very best to make wellness care for feline patients accessible, right? It's about providing evidence-based options for care, and then considering those in light of the pet, the family, and the environment, and taking all of that together while we encourage shared decision-making. So, you know, things that help me is to share and to discuss evidence-based guidelines, like those from American Heartworm Society, like those from CAPC, who have also recently updated their feline heartworm guidelines. And so I'm going to focus on talk about those guidelines and include in that conversation why those are the recommendations, right? Help people understand the risk of infection and the clinical disease that infection can cause. It can also be helpful to share the other benefits of routine administration of parasite prevention. So again, we've said it before, but it's not going to hurt to say it again, right? It's not just for heartworm. These products may have activity against other intestinal and ectoparasites as well, some of which may be of zoonotic concern. So we can discuss and emphasize the importance of one health. And when there are objections, right, really listening to and understanding where those concerns lie and what support we can provide to help people come to the decision that's best for their unique pet, their pet owner, their family situation. So, you know, listening to what we hear often, you know, as very legitimate concerns. So, you know, we do hear concerns about cost, the cost of care. And certainly when it comes to cats, well, gosh, dogs too, right? We just said we own dachshunds. They're not always the easiest. So listening to people's very legitimate concerns about the difficulty of medication administration to cats, right? And helping support with solutions there. I think, and you know, Dr. Evison and I at Antech and other people, we've done some other discussions and webinars on heartworm this year, and we've talked about this a few times. And that is that even if screening is declined, right? So if the pet owner is declining screening for financial or other reasons, you can still have a focus on routine administration of prevention, right? So while it would certainly be ideal to establish a baseline reference infection status for all cats prior to starting prevention, when we think about it, testing prior to initiating prevention, like if we focus on dogs, for example, we're really doing that for three big reasons, right? The first is to establish a baseline. Are you infected or not before we start therapy? And that's really important. The second in dogs is if they're antigen positive, if we confirm them to be antigen positive, heartworm infected, we're going to recommend specific adulticidal treatment. And also in dogs, we want to understand if there are circulating microfilariae or not, partly because that helps us confirm our antigen results, and partly because of the potential risk of adverse reaction if we administer a microfilaricidal drug. But as we've discussed, compared to dogs, detection of antigenemia is less reliable in cats. Specific adulticidal therapy is not recommended. And microfilariemia it's uncommon and it's transient. So ideally, we would screen every cat prior to initiation of heartworm prevention. We should do that wherever it's possible. Again, that baseline testing is really valuable information. But if it's not possible for financial or other reasons, I think it is still generally very reasonable to administer routine prevention. From a colleague of mine who reminds me all the time, and I take this very seriously now, and that is to celebrate the wins, right? Just celebrate the wins. That client is there for your expertise, your care, your compassion, your empathy, and they're there. They've presented their patient for wellness assessment and for preventative care, and I'm going to celebrate that win for sure.
I love celebrating wins. That's what I say that a lot too. Sometimes if they decline certain things, but they're there to get their cat vaccinated against rabies, thank you for protecting them against one of the biggest zoonotic diseases that could be, and it's lethal out there. So thank you for doing that. You know,
that's right. Yeah, so celebrate the win for sure.
Stealing that. And as we're wrapping up, what are some resources that are out there for veterinary professionals who want to learn more?
Definitely, I would encourage all veterinarians and all veterinary care teams to familiarize themselves with the American Heartworm Society feline guidelines. These can be found on the heartwormsociety.org website, and the canine guidelines are there as well, of course. And like I mentioned before, capc.org is an excellent resource for all kinds of parasites, heartworm included, and their feline heartworm guidelines have also recently been updated as well. Dr. Pablo Jimenez-Castro, who is Antech Board Certified Parasitologist, and I, we recently wrote an article in Veterinary Practice News on this topic, and we'll share a link for that in the show notes. Dr. Michelle Evison, also from Antech, and I, we recently did a webinar on this topic, and we threw in a little bit of information in there as well on dogs as we enter into what for many is going to be heartworm screening season, and we'll share that link on Antech's Media Hub. And finally, I'll give a shout out to my incredible team at Antech Consultation Services, who are there to talk to veterinarians about their patients, patient assessment, patient testing, patient management questions. We're always here to help. And of course, if you have any specific questions about Antech or Antech offerings, don't hesitate to reach out to your Antech representative.
Well done, my friend. Wow, fantastic. Great information. Dr. Kelly Mitchell, thank you so much for joining us and sharing this great, really great pieces of information. And I wrote down a whole bunch of notes here, right? And my gosh, I got my work cut out for me.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me. It was a lot of fun. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you to Antech for sponsoring this great conversation. Don't forget to rate this webinar this podcast as we continue to grow. And we'll see you next time right here on the Vet Blast podcast. Take care, everyone.
Thank you for listening to the Vet Blast podcast with me, Dr. Adam Christman. Tune in next time. Remember, take care of your animals and always stay pawsome.